Welcome to History's Nightfall podcast. I'm author and broadcaster Dan Jones, and while I was historically consulting on Nightfall, I rang the cast and crew to hear all about creating the world we see in the show. Now, we're getting towards the end of the season, so expect some plot twists and surprises, which means if you haven't watched episode 7 of Nightfall yet, do not listen on. Okay, in this podcast episode, I'll be speaking to director and executive producer and person responsible for building the visual world of Nightfall, Douglas McKinnon, and also actor Bobby Schofield, who plays Parsifal, a self-confessed history nerd who also built up a reputation during production for throwing himself headfirst into his preparation. But before we do any of that, let's recap episode 7, because it's fair to say that on more than one level, it is all kicking off. We have Navarrese rebels losing their hands. The Pope thinks Landry's losing his head.
You take a leave of your senses.
Roland the Bandit is losing, well, a load of his intestines and half of his face. While in the palace, King Philip is losing the will to carry on wearing the crown. And as we all know, there's only one thing to do when that happens.
I wish to drink.
So let's start with drinking, because actually that seems to be a recurring theme in episode 7. Having said he's gagging for a pint,
I wish to drink.
The king gets Landry to take him to the alehouse. Now, if I remember rightly, Denogre was in this selfsame boozer throwing back schooners with Gawain a few episodes ago. How did that work out for them? Well, not perfectly. Gawain's been driven mad by the idea he'll never graduate from supping the sweet brown stuff from tankards to getting his lips around the grail, while Denogre has been kicked out of the palace and is skulking around the city dressed in sackcloth, totally out of the loop.
The queen is with child.
But back in the pub, well, Philip plainly doesn't spend a lot of time in taverns, because if he did, he'd realise that when a big, hard bloke spills your pint, getting all up in his grill is only going to end up in physical violence.
Let it go.
On the other hand, Philip was really looking forward to that beer.
I wish to drink.
So someone spills Philip's pint, and obviously, fighting ensues. Landry has to sort it out, but that gets him into trouble back at the temple with Gawain.
You smell of ale.
Yeah, Gawain, but you smell of treachery, me old China, and I think we know which one of those is worse. Now, while the king is out fighting booze hounds, Queen Joan has gone down to her ancestral lands in Navarre to have a fight of her own. There's trouble brewing with her cousin Elena in Catalonia, and Joan's taking charge. Landry shakes off his hangover and gets back on the hunt for the Grail, which is now getting tantalisingly close.
Landry.
The person helping him out is an old crone called Anna, played by the delightful Gina McGee, who looks like she's been to the same sackcloth outfitter as Denogre. Like everyone else in this episode, Anna's thirsty.
I'd like some wine, please. I know you monks have the good stuff here.
But on the other hand, she does really know where the Grail is, and she's happy to take Landry and Gawain to see it.
Why is the crypt?
So where is it?
This is as far as I go.
Well, this is kind of weird, but actually it's up an orange tree in a box in the middle of a nunnery. I guess now we know where the Brotherhood of Light got all those oranges from.
That's it?
Yes, Gawain, that is it. In Gawain's case, he's also more concerned with getting his own back on Landry for refusing to let him drink from the Grail than he is with wondering what it was doing up a tree, so he starts a fight.
You're our master, our leader, and you spat on every value we hold dear.
And loses.
If I was a better Templar, I would kill you.
I did say at the start, it was all kicking off. And guess what? We're still not done, because back at the temple, Parsifal's killed Roland, but in turn got himself stabbed to death by Pierre. And to top it all off, Anna has some big news for Landry.
I'm your mother.
This is all getting too much.
I wish to drink.
Let's get on with the show. Now, one storyline that's been brewing and stewing and bubbling away during the last couple of episodes of Nightfall is the family bust-up between Queen Joan and her cousin, Queen Elena of Catalonia. Now, obviously, this has already worked out quite badly for Elena's son, Luis. But there's been more to this feud than just Greek fire and failed weddings. And I think what's really interesting about it is the way that the Joan and Elena story has been used to expand the show's action out of France, hundreds of miles to the south of Paris, into the kingdoms of medieval Spain. Now, if you remember, at the end of last week's podcast, we talked a bit about Catalonia. So now I want to zone in on the history behind Joan's trip to Navarre. We see her learn that Elena is on the attack, and much to Philip's annoyance...
My dear, you have no idea what the blood of battle is like.
Neither do you.
She heads off on her own to sort things out. What might seem confusing is that Joan actually cares about what's going on down in a small kingdom south of the Pyrenees. After all, I mean, she's Queen of France, right? Well, in fact, this is the Nightfall writers drawing on an interesting hinterland from the real, historical Queen Joan's personal story. Back in the 10th century, so that's about 400 years before the events in Nightfall, Navarre had been a serious player in Spain. You've got to remember, this is long before Spain, as we know it now, was unified into a single kingdom. In the Middle Ages, it was divided into smaller Christian kingdoms in the north and Islamic emirates in the south, all of whom basically took it in turns to declare war on one another. By the 14th century, Navarre had lost most of its power to the extent that the crown belonged to a woman, and that woman, Joan, was an absentee ruler. She'd been born in France, married young to Philip IV of France, and in reality, she never visited her kingdom of Navarre. It was controlled instead by French governors, who were widely disliked, and the people of Navarre resented the fact that their queen was nowhere to be seen. In fact, there was a slight sense that she had been, for want of a better word, permanently kidnapped by the King of France. Anyway, when the Nightfall writers were looking at Joan's storyline for the show, I think the fact that she had this connection to Navarre was pretty alluring, because in dramatic terms, it offered the chance to give her another layer of conflict. Now, we've seen plenty of the romantic torture she's been going through with Landry, but here was a chance to throw her into a proper political subplot of her own, feuding with her cousin, defying her husband's wishes, and also getting out of Paris for a bit. Okay, so I'm sure we're going to come back to Joan before this podcast series is out, but now I want to turn to a broader aspect of Nightfall, and this is something I've really wanted to talk about since we got started. We've spoken a lot about the relationship between history and invention in Nightfall, and all the thought and the detailed work that goes into creating a believable world to bridge the two. So one of my very favourite people to talk to about this, or actually talk to about anything, is my first guest on today's podcast.
Hi, Dan. What do you want?
He's the director and executive producer, Douglas McKinnon.
Well, I mean... from all departments, from costume to makeup to kind of more obviously production design, and from my end as well, I think the amount of work that goes in is enormous. I think we probably all try and completely immerse ourselves in these worlds, and then hope that what comes out is a very coherent sort of thing that tells the story best of all. And somehow you reach a point where you've completely immersed yourself and you reach a point of saturation, and then it becomes quite simple in a way, because we know the world that we're dealing with. But, you know, in the end, it's a fictional world. So it's not a historical representation of something. It's more, it's a good go at historical representation, but it has to fit the fiction that we're telling. I'd say, as you know, the actual amount of information is really quite limited. You know, the actual amount of real information and real... I mean, it's the funny, the sort of stuff that you need to know is the everyday humdrum stuff about what would happen in the Palace Street, what shops would be there at that time, what would people be wearing, how would they live, and we build up a picture bit by bit to try and give a pretty accurate portrayal of it. But as I say, in the end, it has to serve the story as well. So it's got complex forces vying against each other and for each other. So I think the key for me is that every department works very hard in their own corner, if you like. We spend a lot of time trying to get stone right, you know, for instance, in Paris, and we worked out how the stone would be affected by the dirt that would be around, and yet you don't want to go too far because you don't want to make it horrible for people to watch. So you're sort of making judgments all the time about all these different elements and trying to present a coherent world, really. It's the coherence, I think, is the target for me as a director, because that's what people should be turning up and not really noticing the world, they should be noticing the story. We actually ended up going through a whole pattern of design of that seemed to last for from the medieval times to now, just about, with the different tones and colours that we'd use, because we didn't want to make it feel bland and we didn't want to go over the top with colour. But again, when you look at the representations in paintings and so on of medieval Paris, which is pretty much what we have, it was a very colourful time. You know, it wasn't a dark and awful sort of time without colour. So we nothing is too nerdy. I mean, I remember, I think, speaking to you about this and realising that I was looking up stuff that I was getting from books that wasn't on the internet, for instance. That's how deep it was. I think it was... Do you remember there was some sort of light that used to hang over the beds of the nobility, and I'd found a reference to it in one book that I found in the University of St Andrews, and I put it into the net, and there was nothing there, literally nothing. So we're on the edge of internet knowledge, and I kind of think we're probably in the right place if you're doing that. You're probably in a good place because you're actually going past the limits of general knowledge and into something very deep and immersive indeed.
Actually, I think that's a great place to be. Now, on an earlier podcast, I think it was episode 5, I talked to the showrunner Dominic Minghella about the Templar cross, which is used on the Templar flags in Nightfall. And at that time, I said I wanted to delve into this a bit further. So while I had Douglas on the phone, I asked him about the same thing.
I think that's a very complex question, which is what I would expect from you. But I remember us going through the different flags, and as you know, there's a Maltese flag version of it. There's a cross with a Maltese with a little point. What do you call them? The little pointy bits.
Douglas is talking there about a cross pâté where the ends of each arm of the cross are flared. But we can go with pointy bits.
Then there's the most straightforward cross that people would regard as a Christian cross, a Christian symbol. And we had all sorts of conversations, I remember, about, and all sorts of designs that were flying around about what might be distinctive and yet be truthful. You know, because one of the things that I was looking for visually was when we had a whole pile of shields, for instance, that there would be a really distinctive pattern that we could see. And I felt quite strongly that the Maltese cross wasn't the right one for us somehow. And you know, in the end, the authenticity is absolutely there as the backbone of it. But there's also a bit of taste that has to fly in as well. Because we're making it for a contemporary audience. So if you went too kooty, you know, in my view, we ended up switching off a lot of the audience. So in the end, it comes down to, you know, a few individuals' taste and judgment about what's right. But obviously, Dan, listening to you in the end for historical authenticity was all our target.
I knew there was a reason I liked him. Now, the next question I had for Douglas concerned other examples of the Middle Ages being portrayed in TV and film, and I wanted to know what shows or films he thought got it right or got it wrong.
Well, I'd actually say that although we looked at, you know, as I think people would expect, I looked at every knight in shining armor film that has ever been made, I think, and I learned quite quickly that, you know, how some people talk about films as being timeless, that there was actually quite a few films in this genre that were the opposite of that. I don't think we ever worked out what the opposite word to timeless is. But I certainly watched films that were like that. I wouldn't name any for fear of being sued. But I actually think that some of the books that you recommended to me were actually much more useful because not only the actual, you know, the Templars sort of book of rules, but also there was a couple of the battle ones that really give insight that, you know, some of the historical accounts, the few historical accounts that there actually are of how people existed in battle and how they survived and the pain and everything else. And I think one of the things that I tried to do was, and we didn't completely succeed in this, but we went quite far down the road. I really wanted to make sure that when we did battles that people saw the human suffering properly. Because I felt a consistent thing that would happen would be people would have sword fights and whack each other across the head and they'd actually just topple over and die or live to fight another day without any consequence whatsoever. Whereas in Nightfall, what I feel like we've tried to do is actually show people that, you know, not only did they get injuries, but the injuries carried forwards into their lives and had implications as well. I think that was one of the targets that we partly achieved, and certainly that was an attitude that I took into the battles, that, you know, people didn't die quickly from these swords, did they? You know, that was a big thing. People died really kind of slowly, and as they got injured, it wasn't a happy time. There wasn't a sort of bunch of medics hanging around on the edges waiting to bandage you up and put you off to hospital. You know, it was a really awful, you know, grimy experience, and that's what I wanted to get to. And I think we've done that with Nightfall.
Now, Douglas mentioned there that I gave him a list of Templar books to go and read. And if you want to dive into really serious Templar scholarship, I think the two must-read authors are Malcolm Barber and Helen Nicholson. But of course, there's also a tremendous recent book by a guy called Dan Jones, available now from all good bookstores. Okay, I'm getting death stares across the studio. The last thing I asked Douglas about was the complexities of how people acted around each other. Mannerisms and behaviour, basically, in the Middle Ages. And I asked him to talk a little bit about how Nightfall's creators built up not just a physical version of the Templar world, but also a social and cultural one.
Yeah, and I think all these, you know, you almost take us back to where we started from, because I think one of the things that I found fascinating is just what those mannerisms and what, you know, what the bowing and scraping would look like. How would people come in to... How would they approach a king or a queen? How would they leave them? Would they bow? Would they curtsy? Would they defer to them? Would they stand aside as they walk through a crowd? And we put all of those things into a general crowd pattern. But I think you end up with a vocabulary on screen that is very different from other shows. Whether it's better or not is for the world to decide in the future. But we certainly have a different vocabulary that we sort of partly made up, because there's limited, you know, as you know, there's a limited amount of knowledge about it, but also through a good base of understanding how people would regard the kings and queens and what they would do to look after them on a daily basis, and what the courtiers would be doing, and how the king or queen would be allowed to speak first. And, you know, and Dominic McGill, our amazing showrunner, was very conscious of that. And, you know, we worked hard, as you know, to build a lot of these behaviour patterns into the scenes and make use of them for storytelling points as well. So I think in amongst all that, and it's the same with the Templars, again, you know, when we were doing the court scenes about who was in charge, were they really all equal? And it's kind of, you look at the rules that are there on the page for us to see, and then you introduce human beings into it. And as we know, human beings, generally speaking, follow rules. And I think one of the interesting things, conversations that I remember having with you all the time was, you know, you would be saying, well, the Templar would have this rule, so they wouldn't do this or that. And my argument would always be, yes, but they're a human being, so they don't follow the rules. And in a way, that's the conflict. You know, we explore the rules by breaking them, you know, in the series, don't we? You know, especially with, you know, one of our main characters.
Human beings don't follow the rules. I think I'm going to make that my motto from now on. Now, speaking of not following the rules, I mentioned earlier in this episode of the podcast how much I enjoyed the sight of King Philip IV of France going out on the town with Landry, Master of the Temple.
Tonight you're not a monk and I'm not a king, now drink.
And getting into a spot of bother as a result. Now, when I spoke to Ed Stoppard, who plays Philip, I asked him about filming that scene, and here's what he had to say.
I don't drink very much, if I'm honest. And there's a scene where Tom and I go to the pub. And so the props boys had given us non-alcoholic beer, right?
Right.
And we'd done about four takes of this. And I said to Tom, I said, Tom, are you feeling... And he went, what? And I said, you're not feeling a bit pissed, are you? He went, no, why? And I went, are you sure this is non-alcoholic beer? And he went, yeah, of course it is. And I said, God, he's a bit pissed, actually. And he kind of looked at me, and he's Welsh, with all due respect. Welsh, he's young, he's Welsh, he's got a beard. And so he kind of went, you're having me on. I went, no, I think my brain, my taste buds are sending a message to my brain going, guys, it's beer, it's beer, it's beer, it's beer. And my brain kind of went, oh my God, we're drunk. We're drunk, everyone, we're drunk. And I went, I feel a bit drunk. And he went, you can't, it's Caliber. It's like, it's got no, and I actually did get, I felt a bit drunk from drinking non-alcoholic beer. Don't, maybe we should cut that.
I think that's probably the only bit we're going to
we
use.
We should
actually.
Probably cut that. That's my favorite. Probably cut that. But I'm that much of a lightweight that it could have been the excitement of the scene, in fairness. Oh, I did a punch up. Actually, that was fun.
You had a punch up?
I had to punch a couple of people. In that scene, I had to punch a couple of people.
Well, do you know what? Maybe you were there in the read-through. My narrative of Nightfall, really, if I'm being honest, is trying to get a small role. And one of the ways I did that was always to make sure I was in Prague during the round table read-throughs of scripts and to offer to read the lines of people who weren't there.
Yep.
And I think when we were reading through that script, I can't remember if you were in the read-through or not, but I was so focused on my own performance, I was given the part of the drunkard who you punched. And I really threw myself into it. And on the way out, Douglas McKinnon just sort of said to me, oh, I like the way you made that camp.
Brilliant.
And that was that.
Yeah, that sounds like a very Douglas. Yeah, listen.
How cruel.
Like, for a start, that's something of the pot calling the kettle black. But secondly, listen, Dan.
Yes, Ed.
You've tattoos, too many tattoos, too visible.
I'm still not sure that's really fair, considering that Tancred has a tattoo on his neck, but okay, let's move on. I'm sure most viewers will agree that the most shocking part of Episode 7 of Nightfall is the death of Parsifal. After a rollercoaster introduction to the Knights Templar, Parsifal has had his revenge finally on Roland in this episode, but then he gets bumped off himself for uncovering too much. Now, Parsifal's been slightly flying under the radar on this podcast so far, so to pay tribute to him, I called the Liverpudlian actor Bobby Schofield, who plays Parsifal, and asked him to talk about his character's journey through the first season of Nightfall.
The way I sort of seen Parsifal was that he wasn't. His main goal is not really to become a Templar. His mind's set on something completely different.
Yeah.
Like the way I seen it through the series. So I think actually becoming a Templar was not something that he really desired to be. I don't even think he actually really wanted to be there. It was just the only sort of option for him to do. So to be interested in what they're doing, I think he was sort of just going along with it for, you know, his own purpose and his own goal.
Well, that's certainly the impression you get, isn't it? I mean, after the sort of first or second episode, you see this kid and you think this is going to be one of these arcs where, you know, young, naive kid from the farm ends up in the temple, discovers the valley. And then actually you see him on quite a subversive journey, sitting there thinking, I don't really, you know, when he's, you have those scenes with Porrig, with Gawain, when he's saying, come on, you're supposed to give out the bread. And you're like, you know what? I'm not here to give out bread. I'm here for pretty much one purpose, right? Which is revenge.
Yeah.
It's a revenge story.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. And that's the way I sort of looked at it. Because when I first read the first description, and after that, I was like, well, I never even read the third or the fourth until I got it. So I was thinking, it completely took me by surprise. I was like, okay, so he's not really that interested in actually doing anything to do with the temple. He's more or less trying to get revenge on a certain someone over something. So, you know, I think that with him was my sort of basis of just being an angry young man.
the original angry young man in some ways. And ultimately, in a sense, Parsifal does get his revenge. In fact, not just in a sense. He takes it in pretty much the most brutal way imaginable, doesn't he? When he finally gets to Roland with the axe. But then there's this turn where suddenly Parsifal's gone as well. How do you think viewers will feel about that?
I'd say that he didn't have his justice yet, but I think it's very quite a sad story what happens to him.
Quite a sad story indeed, but very true of the age, because let's face it, not everyone has a happily ever after in the Middle Ages. So now we come to the section of the podcast where I answer your queries, and this week's I think is a really good one. It comes on Twitter from a user who calls himself, or herself, I suppose, Landry. I don't think it's Tom Cullen, but let's see. Landry says, in all seriousness, Where are all the hashtag Nightfall RPers? I think RPers, I'm pretty sure RPers, means role players. And that's a very good question. Now, personally, I limit my Templar role play to Halloween when I bring out my annual bloodstained Templar knight uniform, complete with my own chainmail. But I've got a funny feeling there's probably a much more committed Nightfall cosplay crew out there. So, if you like dressing up as Landry, or you spend your weekends putting a tea cosy on your head and a pair of bushy eyebrows on and going around quoting Latin at people like Pope Boniface,
Sancti Apostoli Petrus e Paulus,
then please hit us up with your selfies, which I'll be very glad to post or retweet on the internet and then discuss at length before we get to the end of this podcast series. If you want to do that, or you want to get in touch about anything else, then please search Nightfall or History on Facebook or Twitter, or you can tweet me directly at DG Jones. You can also leave us a comment or question when you rate and review this podcast. And that, well, that brings us to the end. In the next episode, we'll be speaking to creepy uncle and escaper of the gibbet of Montfaucon, Julian Ovenden, and we'll be on the line with Princess Isabella, that's Sabrina Bartlett. So please subscribe to the podcast and come back again next week. For now, though,
I wish to drink.
Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.